Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and today I'm with Professor Elisa Bimporad to discuss her new book, Legacy of Blood, Jews, Pogroms, and Ritual Murder in the Land of the Soviets, which delves into two of the Tsarist administration's most tenacious anti-Semitic legacies, pogroms and the blood libels. Professor Bimporad has taken this legacy into the Soviet era with a keen examination of the Soviet myth that the Bolshevik regime had eradicated both pogroms and the blood libel. The result is a meticulously researched book that is thought-provoking and in many ways timely, as Russia continues to grapple with prejudice of all kinds in the 21st century. The book has garnered professional accolades of all kinds, including winning the National Jewish Book Award for Modern Jewish Thought and Experience. And I'm so delighted that it has brought Professor Elisa Bimporad to the podcast today. Elisa, welcome.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, let's begin with a brief overview of your extremely distinguished academic career. And I wonder if you could take us through how you came to concentrate on Jewish studies.
So I was not born in the Soviet land. I was actually born in the land of balsamic vinegar. I grew up in the land of balsamic vinegar and Pavarotti. So I'm from Italy and I grew up in Modena. And in Modena, in my parents' library, I came across the work of Tolstoy, actually the Cossacks, in the edition of Einaudi. And I began, as I was a teenager, I began to read about Russia through Russian literature. And when I started university at the University of Bologna, I decided that I wanted to learn Russian and I wanted to focus on Russian history. And then I found this course on the history of the Jews of Russia, actually a comparative approach to the shtetl, the village where Jews, you know, the small town where Jews lived, and the mir, where Russian peasants lived, right? The organization. So I decided to focus, you know, from there, I decided to focus on the history of the Jews of Russia, and which is not a specialty in Italy. So from Italy, I moved to New York for a second MA and then to Stanford, where I decided to focus on the history of the Jews in the Soviet Union.
So it always begins with Tolstoy, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. But I think Russian studies is very much the richer for your sacrifice of leaving the land of balsamic vinegar for the land of Russian studies. Now, before we begin, because many of our listeners will know the answer to this question, but some will not, and I want to make sure we get this right, because your whole book is sort of premised on this. Could you outline for us what exactly the blood libel is, what its origins are, and how does this form part of the sort of very common beliefs of ordinary people up to the 20th century, to the years right before World War I and the Russian Revolution?
Sure. So the blood libel is the centuries-old accusation made against Jews, according to which they need the blood of Christians, usually Christian children, in order to carry out specific rituals, primarily the ritual of Passover. So they need the blood of Christian children to, as a fundamental ingredient for the unleavened bread, the matzah. The first blood libel actually takes place in England in the 12th century. And there are instances of blood libel accusation throughout the Middle Ages, early modern period in Christian Europe. And it becomes rather widespread in Eastern Europe as well. What is so interesting is that historians have tended to focus primarily on only on the blood libel in the context of the early modern period, and have kind of not focused enough on this, on the persistence of this accusation in modern times, which is one of the things that interests me. First of all, if we think about the question of bulimia in this accusation, we have to also consider the power of the irrational, the power of irrational thinking. This echoes in today's political life in America, but the power of rational thinking and the dark side of modern times, right? The anxiety that modern times unleash in people leads them to believe in mythical accusations like the blood libel, which is also very much connected to folklore in certain parts of Eastern Europe. In some cases, it was exploited by political forces. They did not necessarily believe in this accusation, but they exploited it for other reasons. But in the Russian context, what is interesting is that there is a cultural legitimacy of this accusation that persists for a longer period of time. Think about Dostoevsky, who might have believed that, you know, certain sects of Jews did carry out this this crime. And the Tsar, Nicholas II, most likely believed that that Jews did carry out this crime. So,
it's called the libel because there is absolutely no evidence in any part of history that this ever happened, that there was a ritual murder of a Christian child for the purpose of celebrating Passover.
Right. Most what is so interesting is that the Pope, for example, in Christian Europe, several times intervened, with a very clear statement saying this has never happened. This goes against the beliefs of Jews. Right. One of the prohibitions is that Jews cannot consume blood. It really has to do with. I think it has to do a lot with folklore, folk belief, but as you say, you know, there is no evidence whatsoever that this.
And there is a strong strain in Russian folklore of you know, I'm going to take these children and cut them up and eat them, you know, Baba Yaga and all these classic fairy tales. But as a food writer, I can just say. You look at matzah, and there's no way there's blood in it.
No, there is no way.
So it beggars belief, actually. So you have this idea, and I think pogroms, it's clear, is a sort of state-sponsored violence. So you put these two together, and could you tell us a little bit about your methodology? How did you start? How did this book start to sort of talk to you from the archives?
Well, I can tell you, actually, the idea to write this book came to me, first of all, through an anecdote. When I was in Vilnius about 10 years ago, Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, I became very close with a colleague who teaches early modern Eastern European history, and she was teaching a course on the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. in, of course, in early modern times. And she was talking about the culture and the religion of the different ethnic minorities living in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And it was, when she was talking about Passover, it coincided with Passover and Easter at the time. And so she decided to bring to class matzah so that her students could taste it, something that you cannot find in the supermarkets in Lithuania. And of the 40 students, only about 5 students tasted it. And I was very naive and I asked why. And she said to me, why are you asking why if you work on Eastern Europe? So that triggered my interest. Mm. At the same time, I was reading the Soviet press from the 1930s, especially in Yiddish, the Soviet Yiddish press. And I found reference to blood libel accusations happening in the Soviet Union in what was supposed to be an atheistic society that had uprooted anti-Semitism, but there were blood libel accusations and there were investigative commissions that were, pursuing the investigation of those who had made the accusation. So I was very much intrigued by this. At the same time, I thought this is something that we associate only with Tsarist Russia. What is it doing in the Soviet context? So this was what kind of got me interested. In terms of the pogroms, I quote unquote found the pogroms in the archives. Many years later, I had a fellowship that allowed me to do work, to carry out work in the YIVO archive, the archive in New York City, YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, that holds one of the most extraordinary archives in terms of the study of 20th century Jewish history. The archives put together by historian Elias Cherikov, who was from Ukraine, and he systematically recorded the pogroms that took place during the Civil War from 1917 until 1921. Mm-hmm. And he collected witness accounts. And I found the accounts of a woman that really got me thinking about how different these pogroms were. In many instances, these pogroms, this kind of collective anti-Jewish violence, became genocidal. And this woman, collected, her name is Rachel Feigenberg. She collected witness accounts and she wrote the history of destruction of different small towns, of different shtetlach. And so this got me thinking, what is the legacy of this violence for those Jews who remained in the territories that became the Soviet Union? In terms of methodology, I know I'm talking a lot, but in terms of methodology, I kind of connected the blood libel with the pogrom because they are very much connected in history and in memory. In many instances, the pogroms that took place in the different waves during the 19th century and early 20th century and pre-revolutionary times were triggered by a blood libel accusation. Oh, the child has disappeared. It must have been the Jews, and then the Jews are attacked. It is very much connected, this kind of the rhetoric of violence with actual violence in Russian Jewish history. So I wanted to see how this played out in the Soviet context.
And what you found, your book kind of bucks the traditional idea that the Bolsheviks came in and they said, okay, no more religion and no more anti-Semitism. But it's more subtle than that, as I think your book really, really outlines it in a very cogent and very compelling way. Take us through the years of World War I and then the revolution and perhaps onto the Civil War, and how attitudes towards the Jews change on the hand of the Bolsheviks, but also how the Jews begin to look at the various options that are presented to them.
So what I really try to explain, especially in the first part of the book, is how this, what I call the Soviet-Jewish alliance, it is built on this kind of very ambivalent foundation, shaky foundation and ambivalent foundation that changes over time. So first of all, most Jews were strongly anti-Bolshevik. Right after February 1917, there's a tiny percentage of Jews who are supporting Lenin and the Bolshevik view of society and view of how the revolution should take place. Most Jews are anti-Bolshevik, of course, because the large majority of Jews in Tsarist Empire are rather traditional, and the Bolsheviks are opposed to religion. They're anti-Bolshevik because, according to, you know, the Bolsheviks, there should be no private property. So it's about nationalizing property, and most Jews are small peddlers, so they're opposed to it. And also, Lenin and Stalin, as of 1913, have denied very clearly that Jews are a nation, right? Jews are a caste, as Lenin said. Jews have no national rights. So Jews who are Bundist, meaning Jewish socialists or Zionists of different kinds, are opposed to the Bolsheviks precisely for this reason. But in the midst of the Civil War, when the Civil War that begins right after the Bolsheviks come to power in October of 1917 and continues until 1921, until, you know, the Red Army reoccupies the areas, is back in charge politically of the areas that were in the context of the Civil War. Most Jews are faced with a very hard decision to make, and they choose usually the lesser of two evils. They side with the Bolsheviks, with the Red Army, not so much because of ideological reasons, but mostly because the Red Army, compared to the White Ukrainian nationalists and the different peasant bands that participated in the Civil War, the Bolsheviks or the Red Army is the army that carries out less pogroms, less instances of anti-Jewish violence are carried out by the Red Army. Most importantly, the soldiers in the Red Army are punished by Soviet authorities whenever whenever there are instances of pogroms, whereas Ukrainian nationalist Polish troops involved in this very chaotic and violent war do not punish their soldiers. So it is a choice of, you know, so many young Jews join the Red Army. Again, not so much for ideological reasons, but because the Red Army will allow them to carry out acts of revenge, actually, against those who killed their family members. So many Jews joined the Cheka in order to carry out, you know, acts of revenge. By the same token, the Soviet authorities, and especially early on, are looking for allies, and they know that Jews are a likely choice for the secret police and for the, you know, the building of the new state administration, not only because their higher literacy rate, but also because they are politically loyal, potentially politically loyal, because most Jews did not support the whites or did not support the Ukrainian nationalists after 1919. So they are a likely choice in terms of, you know, building up this alliance. There are many limits to this alliance also. But
So can I just ask you, Elisa, the Ukrainian nationalists and the White Army, are they inherently anti-Semitic, or are their forces sort of not kept as tightly controlled as the Reds? And so they let their soldiers kind of go for this widespread violence.
Yeah, this is an excellent point, and I think I tried to bring it out in the book. They're not as tightly controlled as they should be, the soldiers of the Ukrainian forces and of the white forces. So that the whites in particular see the pogrom as a weapon to defeat Bolshevism, to keep, you know, what is a pogrom? The pogrom is, yes, there is killing, but it's primarily looting. And looting is a driving force for these soldiers, for the peasant bands, who, by the way, we have to remember the context. I mean, these are not people who are, as you mentioned, inherently anti-Semitic necessarily, but these are people who have suffered and who are suffering the extraordinary, circumstances, especially in the countryside, famine,
war.
And, you know, the dire circumstances since World War I. And so the idea, the possibility of looting is driving them. And in the midst of looting, the killing escalates, and it varies, of course, from place to place. But the pogrom is seen as a weapon to defeat Bolshevism. We do have evidence, for example, of the fact that Semyon Petliura, who was the leader of the Ukrainian forces, did condemn pogroms, but he condemned it very often. He condemned this kind of violence ex post facto, and he condemned it in some places. He condemned it, but not everywhere, because again, the pogrom seems useful to bring together these soldiers, these forces.
I see. And you also go into a lot of detail in your book about sort of the rapes that take place to even quite young women and girls. Was that a motivating factor for the whites as well, or just an offshoot of the pogrom, I suppose?
I think it's a combination of both, and it's an upshoot of the pogroms. Rape has been part of the pogroms since, the pogroms. Think about Kishinev in 1903. In this case, during the Civil War, the rape really escalates and becomes widespread, and is often used as a weapon of war and as a weapon of ethnic cleansing. Very often Jewish women, young Jewish women, are being raped in front of other members of their families, parents. But it is a way to punish Jews for their propensity for communism, right? They're being punished for supporting the Reds, for supporting communism, so that the males of the family, of the community, are being punished through the rape of women. What is so, one of the reasons why I became so interested in this war was precisely mass rape. Perhaps as many as one third of Jewish women, in particular in Ukraine, where the civil war reaches it, where the epicenter of anti-Jewish violence takes place, one third of Jewish women were raped, most likely, which has long-term consequences, of course, for the Jewish community in the interwar period.
And how so? You go into detail later in the latter part of the book about sort of the journey of Jewish women. But what is the immediate effect in the interwar period?
The immediate effect that we see, as early as 1920, hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees, and so many people, families decide to leave their, you know, the city of death, the shtetl of death, because of the civil war. So the demographic revolution that takes place for the, you know, for Jews after the revolution is not so much triggered only by the great opportunities that the Soviets offer Jews in, you know, Moscow and the other metropolises, but it's really it's about fleeing the violence, the trauma. Mm-hmm. And so many Jewish women and their families flee the centers of this violence. Fleeing also means preventing further rape, right? So I'm going to leave now so that this doesn't happen again. For Jewish women, there is also a decline, significant decline in the natality rate. And actually, I found many accounts by Soviet demographers who are very much concerned about the fact that Jewish women are having less babies because, you know, and one of the causes is, of course, rape. Venereal disease, women who, some Jewish women will commit suicide as a result of rape. But also we have to think about, you know, how trauma is internalized. It's not always by, you know, by remembering the trauma, but it's also by trying to forget the trauma. So oblivion through intermarriage, through very successful horizontal socialization that takes place as Jews leave these centers of violence.
Right. And they go to, I wouldn't say that the Bolsheviks welcome them with open arms, but in the beginning, particularly it struck me in your book in the 1920s, they're very keen to have the Jews come and work in the nascent government. But you have a wonderful phrase where you say, that the Bolshevik attempts to counteract anti-Semitism fluctuates between public condemnation and utter disregard, which I thought was a great phrase. But how do the Jews fit into the Bolsheviks' overall attempts to kind of completely remake society? And how do they galvanize the Jews in that effort?
So I would say that fighting against anti-Semitism is seemingly a priority for the Bolsheviks in the beginning, right? When Lenin in March 1919, he condemns the pogroms, anti-Semitism is outlawed. It's not so much that they're trying, well, it is a combination of trying to appeal to that Soviet Jewish alliance, but it's most importantly, an attempt to distance themselves from the political enemy number one, which was Tsarist Russia, right? So if late imperial Russia was so prone to anti-Semitism, encouraging pogroms, encouraging ritual murder accusations. Think about the Bailey's Affair, 1911-1913. The Soviet Russia, so the Soviet Union is saying very clearly, we have nothing to do with this. We reject this. But of course, you know, anti-Semitism is something that the Soviets remain committed to only as far as this is in the interests of the state. And there is the ambivalence can be seen very early on. I think in the trials, what I found fascinating in the trials, the Soviet trials against those who participated in the pogroms, whereby these people who participated in anti-Jewish violence are not being accused of anti-Semitism in any way. They're being accused of carrying out acts of counter-revolution. So they are against the revolution, but they're not necessarily anti-Semitic, meaning that already here you see how the Bolsheviks will be going back and forth between playing the card of anti-Semitism, but then retracting it when it is no longer in the interest of the state.
I see. And at the same time that this is going on, there is the vigorous and very sort of robust attempts to sort of really rid the country of any religious affiliation, and of the anti-religious campaign, the atheists, the sort of push to atheists. How does the fight against anti-Semitism fit it, get baked into this during the 1920s and 30s?
So the fight against Judaism is in no way does it grow out of anti-Semitism. You know, the previous scholarship has seen a connection between the anti-religious campaign on the Jewish street and Soviet anti-Semitism. But in fact, as we know, if there was one religion that was singled out by the Soviets, this was a Russian Orthodoxy, again, because of this close alliance between the Tsar and the church. What is so interesting about the anti-religious campaigns that are carried out, you know, throughout the Soviet Union in terms of anti-Judaism, what I found fascinating was that for the very first time in Jewish history, some of the rituals, some of Jewish rituals, were put on trial, right? Kosher slaughtering, circumcision in particular, are being demonized in these anti-religious campaigns. And what happens is that by demonizing these these Jewish rituals, inadvertently, the Soviets remind the reader of other Jewish rituals, alleged Jewish rituals, like the blood libel. Demonizing Judaism inadvertently encourages anti-Semitism because, of course, you know, if you think about this extraordinary, for historians, publication, Bezbozhnik Ustanka, The Atheist at the Workplace, which, you know, which was one of the most widespread publications in the Soviet Union, it reached 200,000 copies. And it was a publication that was intended as a major propaganda tool to defeat religion in all its manifestations. But you can imagine that someone who already had perhaps had contact with some kind of anti-Jewish stereotypes and then was given this publication and saw these, you know, demonizing depictions of Judaism could be reminded of anti-Semitic prejudice. And could perhaps misunderstand and reinforce and be reinforced in these beliefs by the state itself. Again, it's not the Soviet state's intention, but it is an inadvertent consequence of this propaganda.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com. nbn50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So at the same time, the Jews are taking the opportunity to process their trauma, their memory of the pogroms, of the difficulties of the Tsarist era. And I wonder if you could walk us through what forms this take and how effective are these attempts, how tenacious are these attempts to create a sort of memorial texts and just a living memory for those who've come behind.
I was very much intrigued by the memory of the pogroms in the interwar period and how the pogrom becomes for Jews a Jewish lieu de mémoire, a Jewish kind of site of memory that is preserved through informal meetings, for example, meetings that take place. Even during the 1930s, I found reference to these meetings that take place in the synagogues or around the synagogues or at the site of the massacres. You have memorials that are built at the site of these massacres. They're built usually right after the Civil War ends, very often with the support of those Jews, probably relatives or members of the same community who have managed to reach the United States and send funds to build these memorials. Think about the memorial in Praskurov or Praskuriv, today Khmelnytsky in Ukraine, which was the site of one of the worst instances of anti-Jewish violence. More than 1,500 Jews were killed just in a few hours. And this memorial is still standing today. And there are other memorials. So there is this history isn't quite studied enough. But these meetings are informal, meaning that the state does not intervene. Again, why? And here we really kind of touch upon this, the ambivalent relationship between the ambivalence of the Soviet-Jewish alliance. For the Soviets, the pogrom has to be a universal lieu de mémoire, a universal site of memory, whereby all people who supported the revolution were targeted for violence by the counter-revolution. Jews did not suffer more than others. In terms of this memory that becomes more and more universal, so the state is really pushing for a universal memory by the end of the 1930s, you see it also in some Jewish publications, in some works of literature, mostly in Yiddish, that are produced in the 1930s, where this, you know, the memory of this violence, once it becomes official, it has to be a universal memory. It has to be, you know, rewritten through the lenses of revolution versus counter-revolution versus revolution. Mm-hmm. One of the points that I want to make is that, this memory, these pogroms are largely forgotten, of course, because they are, obfuscated by the memory of the Holocaust. It took place some 20 years later in the same territories, right? The epicenter of the violence was Ukraine. And those Jews who retained this memory, and I talk about them in the 1930s, right? Who retained this memory of violence, and who stayed in those territories and decided not to move to the metropolises are those who were killed so successfully once the German army attacks the Soviet Union in June 1941. So even for that reason, that memory is lost.
Right. And any attempts, I think your book makes clear, to sort of combat anti-Semitism fall by the wayside, particularly in Ukraine, as the Nazis occupy. And it seems that it doesn't take them much effort to revitalize those ideas of blood libel and violence against Jews being warranted with the local population, which does linger through the war and then indeed after the wars. Is that right?
Yes, I think that the Soviets were actually rather successful in taming popular anti-Semitism. You see this in the archives that I've used, in the archival material I've found for the 20s and 30s in Ukraine. You see how successful the Soviet state was in taming popular anti-Semitism. There is a degree of frustration on the part of people, not everyone, but of some, about the fact that pogroms are no longer allowed in the Soviet Union, right? The Soviet Union does not allow this kind of spontaneous anti-Jewish violence as a way of punishing Jews for some crimes allegedly committed. But once you have the war of extermination that is launched by the Germans, once you have this systematic exterminatory rhetoric and practices that is being carried out by the Germans as of 1941 and throughout the war, the theme of this alliance between Jews and the Soviets and the possibility of punishing Jews for these alleged crimes reemerges very, very much so. The Germans themselves actually employ to some degree in their propaganda the ritual murder, right? Mm-hmm. There is an attempt to distribute pamphlets that that encourage the locals to, engage in anti-Jewish violence because Jews are killing non-Jews for ritual purposes. And of course, there is this propaganda that encourages the idea of Judeo-Bolshevism. But I do want to emphasize the fact that the Soviets are rather successful in the interwar period in taming popular anti-Semitism.
But after the war, it seems there's kind of an acute and somewhat disturbing rise of anti-Semitism, and I think with Stalin kind of at the center of that, isn't it?
Yes, and I mean the legacy of this, of course, is the war of extermination. As I said, people have gotten used to treating Jews and viewing Jews through the lenses of this exterminatory practice and rhetoric. The rise in anti-Semitism, of course, has to do with, there are different reasons. The establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, the emergence of the Cold War, and, the connection between the West and the apolitical enemies, and the fact that many Jews have relatives in the West does play out. But it's also, to go back to the war, it also is connected to the fact that Jews seem to be carving out for themselves this this particular suffering that they experience because of the Holocaust. And in the Soviet context, this particular suffering is not allowed. And I connect mm-hmm. this, there is a legacy in terms of the culture of memory. I mean, it is connected to the Civil War. This particular suffering, particular memory of suffering is not allowed. And the other reason for the rise, of course, in anti-Semitism is the return, the so-called return of the Jews, which has been studied, meaning those Jews who survived the Holocaust and return to their to the cities and their homes. And it has been studied in the context of Poland and other areas of Eastern Europe, but not really in those areas that come under, control of the Soviets, the so-called new lands, right? And the newly occupied territories. But there's a lot of tension, right, that emerges when those who survived, those Jews who survived the Holocaust, return and demand to have their house given back. And I do chronicle some instances whereby the state says, why do you need that house? You know, just, you know, move into this other building. What's the big deal? But nevertheless, there are these tensions that emerge between neighbors because of the legacy of World War II.
And one related trend that I found really fascinating in your book was the shift of focus from the Jewish man as the sort of evil incarnate to the Jewish woman as kind of predatory. And this seems to become more prevalent as we previously spoke about the women move to the urban centers. They become more liberated, empowered. I wonder if you could speak about that a little bit, because the blood libel story seems to change and morph with this trend. And is the notion of a woman as the agent for this ritual murder more horrifying than a man? And how did your research sort of reveal stuff about that?
So I'm very interested in this question of permutation, and as a social historian, right, trying to understand how this accusation that goes back to the 12th century, how it changes over time. One of the changes that we see in the Soviet context, but we also see it elsewhere, is that it is no longer necessarily Christian children who are being targeted for the alleged murder, but it's young women, right? So it's no longer about the reenactment of the killing of Christ, which is at, you know, one of the foundations of the blood libel narrative, but it is actually the young woman who represents the nation that is being kind of attacked by the Jewish enemy. In the Soviet context only, which is fascinating, we have women and not Jewish men. So it's Jewish women and not Jewish men who are accused of carrying out the ritual murder, which doesn't appear in any other context. So this got me thinking, why is that the case? And of course, there always is, when we talk about racism, when we talk about anti-Semitism, we always have to kind of disentangle myth from reality. What I found fascinating is that Jewish women are accused of being perpetrators, right? Of perpetrating ritual murder as a way to punish them for their "quote unquote uppity ways," right? For their because they are empowered. But it is also true that Jewish women, compared to non-Jewish women, are more successful in the beginning, right? So if you look around and you see which woman has a position in
trust and power and
right, socioeconomically or politically, it is more likely to be a Jewish woman because of the higher literacy rates, and there are other reasons, than a Ukrainian woman or a Belarusian woman. And so the empowerment of Jewish women does play out in this accusation. You know, the question you ask, is it more horrifying that this alleged crime is being carried out by a woman? Yes, I would say no, it shouldn't be, but it is.
It is somehow, isn't it? Yeah. I'm not sure exactly why. I'm not sure I can unpack it, but it does seem more horrific.
Well, because we are all trained culturally to think about crimes in a very gendered way. Crimes are carried out by men, right, and not by women. There is this kind, women is the association is motherly, motherly image,
nurturing, not very down gendered. Yeah. Interesting. One of the things that really shocked me when I went to live in Russia and married my husband, who's Russian, and started to sort of talk to people was the prevalence of this conspiracy that you note in your book about the assassination of the imperial family of Nicholas II and his wife and children was done as a Jewish ritual, a murder. And I wonder what the origins of that are. It seems super prevalent in today's society. You talk to well-educated Russians who are convinced that this is the case. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, what is so fascinating actually is that this myth, this mythical accusation, this conspiracy theory became very widespread, or rather widespread in the West as well. This journalist writer by the name of Robert Wilton, who wrote several books in 1918 and in 1920 in Great Britain that were published in Great Britain, he was convinced, and he wrote this in his books, that when the Bolsheviks ordered the murder of Nicholas II and his family, it was actually a ritual murder that, Jews were carrying out, a kind of a more secular version. This also has to do with the permutation of the accusation, a more secular version of the blood libel. What I have seen in the sources that I use is that it appears in the 1920s and in the 1930s. The OGPU, the secret police that will become the NKVD, does record such accusations and such convictions being rather widespread. When the Germans occupy the part of the Soviet Union during Operation Barbarossa during World War II, they also they encounter this belief, and they encourage it, of course. It is about, alleged Jewish political power that is being kind of carried out through Jews embracing Bolshevism, which, by the way, goes back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, right, which is one of the most fascinating, which we haven't really talked about, but I do mention it in the book. The most fascinating document in the history of anti-Semitism, whereby Jews are accused of this kind of world conspiracy taking over and coordinating any event in history in order to take over the world. But this accusation reemerged quite, potently in the latter years of Gorbachev, right? This right-wing group and the publication Pamyat, Memory, published several articles about, the assassination of the Tsar's family, Nicholas II, as ritual murder. The church, very recently, the Russian Orthodox Church launched an official investigation to find out once and for all whether this has indeed been, a Jewish act of ritual murder. I'm not sure what the results of this investigation.
It's still going on. It's still
was launched initiated 2 years ago. Not sure.
It's still dragging on, and I think it's not productive in any way. but that speaks to the fact that none of these conspiracy theories, none of these libels or specters is really vanquished. Although you make the point at the end of the book that, the 400,000 Jews who live in the former Soviet Union are not really in danger of this kind of violence, but that other ethnic minorities and sexual minorities are. I wonder if you could speak about that in conclusion, because that's an interesting way to end your book, I think.
I do believe that in a way, in light of the growing violence against ethnic minorities, especially in Russia today, I do believe that the ethnic minorities from the former Soviet republics, from Africa, members of the LGBTQ community have become Jews, quote unquote, meaning that they are more likely to be the target of collective violence rather than the Jews who are still living in the territories of the former Soviet Union. And even in the context of the war that Putin has launched against Ukraine, illegally taking over Crimea, among other things, what is so interesting is that Putin did play the card, the Jewish card. He did talk about the anti-Semitism, and he talked about the fact that in Russia, there is no anti-Semitism, whereas in Ukraine, there is anti-Semitism because the leaders of Ukraine, I mean, this was 2 years ago, he said this, the leaders of Ukraine are the same, the children of those Ukrainian nationalists who carried out acts of violence, massacres, anti-Jewish massacres during the war. And he said, lo and behold, there will be pogroms in Ukraine. You should support us, Russia, because Ukraine is anti-Semitic. But in fact, there hasn't been one pogrom in one instance of collective violence against Jews in Ukraine.
And Ukraine has a Jewish president.
Yeah, exactly. A Jewish
president. So it's a happy ending.
Many political leaders. Yeah, Zelensky is Jewish, but many other political leaders who are indeed Jewish. Yes.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch what happens next there, because that story isn't over by any means. Tell us what's next for you. What are you working on currently?
I'm currently working on the biography of a Jewish woman who was, I would say, after Rosa Luxemburg, probably the most prolific essayist and writer on the among radical Jewish women. Her name is Esther Frumkin, and she was a member.
Oh, yes. Yes,
you know, she was a member of the Bund, and what is so interesting is that she is, of course, very active as a radical in Tsarist Russia in the latter period of of the 1900s, of the 1910s. I'm sorry, but then she remains very active and becomes a communist during the interwar period. So I'm trying to follow her life and trying to engage with the question of Jews and radicalism. And I'm very much interested in gender. So I want to see, you know, how gender fits in also in this, in the extent to which Jews embraced socialism and then communism in different contexts.
Well, that sounds fascinating, Elisa. Can we get you back on the podcast to discuss that book?
With pleasure, of course.
That's about all that we have time for today. But before we go, I do want to give readers the opportunity to know where they can find more about you and your work online and connect with you. I believe you're on Twitter. Where else can we find you?
I am on Twitter and I am on Facebook, academia.edu. And I would say that's it.
Okay. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion about Elisa Ben-Porod's award-winning book, Legacy of Blood, Jews, Pogroms, and Ritual Murder in the Lands of the Soviets, from Oxford University Press. Elisa, thank you so much for a wonderful discussion.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva. Thanks for listening.